What's going on, everybody? It's Jamel Gibbs, your family-oriented entrepreneur. Welcome to another podcast episode. This is the Business and Investing Podcast, where you learn all things business and investing related. Today, we have a special guest. I actually met Candace, back in, September at Jean's event? Was it August or September? I can't remember.
September.
Yeah, something like that. So, I think it was September in Houston, Texas. And she killed it at the event, and I was begging her to get on my podcast, and we finally made it happen. But so she's a real estate attorney, and she has a ton of knowledge in real estate investing in general. I think she's going to be a great resource for you guys to really tap into with what she's doing and reach out to her as well. So we'll talk about some of that on today's podcast on how you can reach out in order to be able to get some legal information regarding your real estate investing business. So there's a couple of things we're going to talk about today. We'll tap into that in just a minute. Before we actually get into that, Candace, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yes, Jamel, it's great to see you again. We definitely had a ball at the Go-Getter Conference last year. So thanks for connecting with me. I am Candace Patrick on social media. Everybody knows me as Attorney Candace. I kind of got a lot of popularity just from doing funky reels and things like that to educate business owners in general about how to properly run their business, how to grow their business, how to protect it and things like that. And then over time, I started getting clients who are particularly in the real estate investing arena. So I work with all different kinds of business owners, but my biggest clients are typically real estate investors, and people in the logistics industry. And I help my clients with things from contracts all the way down to intellectual property, lawsuits, you name it. So that is who I am. I'm here in the great state of Texas, but fortunately I have clients throughout the U.S.
Cool. So you have a national business, but you're there in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And, yes. You know, again, I met you through Gene. Shout out to Gene Boykin. It's my guy right there. And yeah, I'm looking forward to providing some killer information today for the audience. So how did you become an attorney? Like, why did you tap into the legalese side of things as far as real estate?
Yeah, man, it's a long story. But the small aspect of it is growing up for me was south side of Chicago. So I got to see a lot of things, you know, growing up in that part of town. And one of the biggest things that I paid attention to was the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. People were always going to jail, having to get bonded out, just, you know, things like that. But the biggest thing was the power of the attorney. So every time I saw someone getting in trouble or some type of issue, it was always the attorney, the good attorney that they had that was getting them free from jail or helping them beat the case. So that's kind of what ignited my desire for wanting to be an attorney. And then once I actually went to law school and I learned about business law and all these other different areas of law, then I kind of settled on which area I wanted to focus on.
Got you. Now, When you were in law school, did you think that real estate was going to be, or even the business side of things was going to be the thing that you would be best at?
Well, I knew I would be best at whatever I put my mind to, but when I first went to law school, I was heavily focused on criminal defense. So remember, for me growing up, I was always seeing people in and out of jail, or just the police were heavily involved with our community. And so that is what I wanted to focus all of my attention on. All of my volunteering and internship prior to law school, it was always involved with the criminal justice system. So I was heavily focused on that, and I thrived. Like I always got an A in criminal, anything involved with the criminal system. Mm-hmm. But what happened to kind of change my focus was we only had two Black law professors in the entire law school. And one of them taught business law, and he was brilliant. And then the other one taught entertainment law. So, of course, I could not graduate I could have graduated, let me be clear, but I just was intentional that I did not want to leave law school without taking a class with those two professors. I just thought it was honorable. I wanted them to teach me. And so I fell in love with those courses, like, you know, learning from those Black professors. They graduated from top schools, Yale and things like that. I loved what they taught me, and I kind of fell in love with business law. And then you can't really teach, you can't really practice business law without having some kind of knowledge of intellectual property. So the entertainment law taught me the intellectual property, and that tied right into the business aspect of things.
Got you. Now, did it take a mindset shift for you to, because remember, you were considering criminal law at first. Did it take that a mental shift for you to really get comfortable with the business side of things?
In a way, in a way, yes. And I'll share a brief story with you about what kind of caused me to have a mental shift. And so when you're in law school, you get something called a 7-Eleven license. Now, it might be called something different in different jurisdictions, but in Illinois, it was called a 7-Eleven license. And you get that your second year of law school, and it basically allows you to practice law under the supervision of another attorney. And so with that license, I had my own clientele that I provided criminal defense for, right? And so I had about seven clients at that time, and I used to kick butt. Like, I used to go off. And I remember one client, he was had a lot of tattoos. He was a Black guy. And I remember we had this oral argument in front of the judge, and like, I demolished the state's attorney. It was like, no way they were gonna win, right? But the judge ruled against me. And I remember walking away feeling like, man, like, if I walked in here with the blonde hair, blue eyed client, like, I probably would have won, because there's no way, you know? And in open court, I remember the judge calling out my name saying, Miss Patrick. And I just ignored him because I was like, why is the judge calling my name? Like, I'm trying to leave. And he said it again, Miss Patrick. And I said, yes, judge. And he said, I wanted to let you know that was one of the best oral arguments I've ever heard in this courtroom. And when I left, everybody in the courtroom came in the elevator with me. They were trying to get my card. And I remember thinking, like, man, I know I did a great job, but man, the bias that's involved in a criminal justice system is heavy. And I chose not to have to deal with that every day, right? Yeah. So that was kind of like what kind of ignited my mindset shift, if you will. And so when that happened, I remember thinking, I've mastered business law. So when I took the business law course, I got the highest grade in the entire class on the exam, right? The same for entertainment law. So I thought to myself, those areas of law are more fun. They're more light and airy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would much rather do that on a daily basis compared to criminal defense, where it's heavy, it weighs on you because you have so many other factors to fight against other than just being a great attorney. So that's my little story about how I kind of shifted.
That's a great story. And it really shows the biases that, you know, are that even attorneys face in the legal system. Unfortunately, I mean, if, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about what you just said. If that was the best argument that the judge has ever heard, why did you lose the case? You know what I mean?
Right.
That's just weird to me, but you know, that's something I just, that's above my pay grade. That's above what I understand about the legal system. But you know, it's just that shows the problems that the legal system has as well. So you chose something that was a little easier to stick with, and that's business law. So I kind of want to dig into some of that today. I know we were going to talk about intellectual property, some of the real estate do's and don'ts, and also avoiding, how to avoid the liabilities that come with it. So why don't we start there? Let's get into some of the intellectual property stuff. What are some things that people need to keep in mind, some obstacles that they're going to face when it comes to intellectual property?
Absolutely. So with your channel, all of your audience members are business owners of some sort. Most of them are going to be investing in real estate. And one area that I see a lot of the investors fail at is the intellectual property, right? So they'll have the corporations, the LLCs, all that stuff, right? But they never have their trademarks. They never have the copyrights for their logos and things like that. So I'm glad that we got to talk about this so that now they can be more aware and get on top of it. So let's talk about what intellectual property is. So that is kind of an umbrella term, if you will, mm-hmm. that, you know, has three different categories within it. And so under that umbrella, you have trademarks, which allows a person like you and I to own our brand, right? So the podcast that we're on right now, once you trademark it, you legally own it. So no one else can create a podcast name that you have, right? You legally own it. It is your brand, right? Mm-hmm. And then the next category is the copyrights. So copyrights are going to allow you to take legal ownership over your works of authorship. So any type of work of authorship, I usually reduce it to like artistic works. So that would be like your books that you write, courses that you create, anything where you need to put your name on it as an author, you want to get a copyright. And then the last category is patents, right? And so patents are going to cover inventions. So those are the three types of categories. And the way I look at intellectual property is I look at it just like real estate. When you own real estate, you can do a lot of things with it, right? You can rent it out to other people. You can sell it and make money. You can hold it and you know, live there, use it for your own benefit. Mm-hmm. And so intellectual property works the same way, particularly when it comes to business owners. We want to really focus heavily on the trademark aspect, right? Because most business owners are going to have a company name. That's your brand. They're going to have some type of social media or a logo, right? They're going to have things that allow the public to identify their brand, right? And so you want to legally own it. So you wouldn't invest a lot of your energy and money and resources into a property. You're not going to get a property and just start fixing it up and you have no ownership interest in it, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So intellectual property works the same way. So Jamel Gibbs, right? You want to make sure, hey, I legally own this. This is a part of my brand because there are billions of people in the world. We don't want another Jamel Gibbs to come up and start doing a podcast. It sounds like it's extremely rare, but it happens, you know? So that is just the essence of intellectual property. And when it comes to investors, real estate investors, you guys are usually heavily focused on like the buying and selling of the properties, the LLCs, the taxes and things like that, to where you're not paying attention to something as simple as the intellectual property component. But if you guys start treating intellectual property the same way you do real estate, you guys can make some additional money. Because remember, we can sell our intellectual property. We can also rent it out. Okay. So if you think about like big brands, say, for example, Nike, you can bet your bottom dollar. Anytime you see a third party using their logo, they're paying what's called a licensing fee to Nike to use that logo, right? So you can rent out your intellectual property. You can treat it exactly how you do real estate.
Yeah, or you'll get a cease and desist.
Exactly, a cease and desist. And if you don't listen, we can follow up that by a lawsuit.
That's right. That's right. You know, I created a term, hybrid wholesaling, and I started hearing other people start to use it. So that's the first thing I did. I went and got, basically looked into how I can patent it or, you know, protect that name. And that's kind of what we're working on right now. But, you know, people will steal your stuff if you don't do something.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And that's just, it's just the nature of the beast, right? But because there's nothing original, so to speak, but when there's something original that truly do comes up, people will steal it and make it their own. That's just what it is, right? So, and what are some of the obstacles people might face when it comes to the intellectual property side of things?
One of the biggest obstacles is, you know, at the inception of them creating their business name or their branding, if you will, because a lot of people in that time period, their creative juices are flowing and they're thinking, hey, I came up with this name, right? But they don't go and do any type of, double checking with an attorney, right? So when people are sitting down coming up with their branding, they should say, hey, these are the top three names I came up with for my business. Let me go and pay an attorney for an hour of their time to check these names to see if they're available. If someone has already trademarked it, am I going to be infringing on someone else's intellectual property rights by using this, right? So people don't do that. So that's one of the biggest obstacles, because people will create a brand, create a social media, they'll start using it, putting content out there, start selling stuff, start making deals, you name it. And then next thing you know, they're either getting a cease and desist from another person that owns it, or they come to an attorney like me and they say, hey, I'm ready to trademark. And they've been using it for, say, 5 years. And then I have to tell them, oh, somebody trademarked that 10 years ago. You know what I mean? So that's one of the biggest obstacles that I see business owners facing when it comes to that.
Yeah, and that ties right into, if we're taking it to to the real estate side of things, there's a company out here, it's called Investor, I can't remember the name of the exact company. It's a pretty decent size real estate company, but they own We Buy Ugly Houses, right? And WeBuyUglyHouses.com. So if you use WeBuyUglyHouses.com, or you have a banner sign that says We Buy Ugly Houses, they can force you to take that down because they own the intellectual property to that particular name. So that's what Candace is talking about. You got to be really careful on how you market your business. Now, We Buy Houses is something that I believe they tried to get, but it was so common that they couldn't get it. I can't remember the story on how that actually happened. But the point is, when you own the intellectual property, people can't use it. If they do, they can be sued. They can receive a cease and desist to stop using it. And then the person who owns it will own the rights to use it however they want. So super important. And that goes as far as your real estate company's logos, everything that how you market your business, super, super important to have the intellectual property aspect tied in with this, so that you can market freely and build a real brand around it. Kind of like what Candace was saying, Nike, no one can use Nike, the logo or anything, without paying Nike. And that's what you want in your real estate business as well. Is that about right?
That's absolutely right. And then another thing that I just thought of when you were talking is, people, when they do get to the point of getting the trademark and protecting their brand, they oftentimes only do one class or category, if you will. So when it comes to trademarks, there are about 45 different categories. So you only own the trademark in the category in which you get the trademark registration for. Mm-hmm. So let's say, you might get a trademark for real estate services, right? The actual, the act of, doing the services, you have a company, maybe you're teaching other people how to do what you do. Well, then that's one category. So you'll own it in that, right? But if you don't have a trademark for, say, a separate category that involves in investing, then you run into some problems. So a lot of people don't really think that through. Either they're filing the trademarks themselves, or they're just not really doing the due diligence to articulate to their attorney, hey, this is how I intend to use my trademark in the future. Right. Because sometimes you might start off saying, hey, I just want to run my company and provide real estate investing education to people. But then later next year, you might want to sell real estate investing t-shirts or apparel, right, for your brand. So when you're sitting down with your attorney, get an attorney, a trademark, somebody that knows trademark law. And when you're talking to them, let them know, hey, maybe next year I might expand my brand and start doing clothing and apparel, or I might start doing this, this, and this. And then they can let you know, hey, well, that's going to entail three other categories. Mm. So maybe we need to start planning for your investment to also trademark in those categories.
Got it. Totally understand. Now, by the way, the company, it just popped into my head. The company that owns We Buy Ugly Houses is called Homevestors. So it's a franchise opportunity, right? So you better believe they trademarked all of this stuff. And if you try to use it, you can have some issues down the line. So we got the intellectual property stuff out of the way. So as you're setting up your business, you want to keep these things in mind. Now, what about when you start making some money, you start building your portfolio, there's some liabilities that you want to avoid. What are some of the things that people need to keep in mind when it comes to avoiding liabilities?
Yeah, so particularly for the investors, real estate investors, you want to make sure, like, if you have contractors or something like that coming out to fix up the property, you want to have some type of agreement with them that, you know, either A, is waiving liability for you as the homeowner, you know what I mean? You own that particular real estate investment property. Because if you think about it, if somebody's coming to fix up property, anything can happen, right? They can slip and fall off of the ladder. Like, all type of things can happen. Somebody can hit themselves with a nail, trying to nail something down. It might be rare, but as an attorney, that's the way we think. So A, when you're doing your deals with these contractors, you know, maybe waive liability. If they're not agreeable to that, then just, you know, make sure that you have liability insurance. So that way, if somebody does get hurt on the property and they come after you, then you have some money set aside with the insurance where you don't have to personally pay anybody. So that would be a huge thing, right?
So you got avoiding liabilities with contractors. How about if you own property, somebody slip and fall? I mean, you got insurance for that, but you know, obviously you got entities for that as well, right? So what are some of those things that people should keep in mind?
Absolutely. So when it comes to like having, you know, visitors over on the property and people slipping and fall, it's a whole plethora of things that we consider under the law. So for example, like open and obvious, you know, is it some type of hole or something that they should have saw that, you know what I mean? Or was it something that was maybe covered up by a rug and you should have warned them, right? So you kind of just have to be aware of your property and know, hey, if the rail for the stairs is weak or broken, let me put up a sign to put people on notice that the rail to the stairs is broken, so don't grab it. Or maybe let me just not have visitors during this time period while this is getting repaired. So it really boils down to notice, giving your guests notice, and then also whether the person is, you know, just a regular personal guest or are they coming to do business. So the standard for those different categories are going to change under the law. So if you got a business person coming, if it's someone that's invited to the premises to do business, it's a higher standard that you're required to give them notice, to give them, you know, to make sure they're not injuring themselves versus someone that's just like a personal friend or something like that. But ultimately, in layman's terms, what it boils down to is notice. You want to make sure you're giving them notice, right? If it's not open and obvious, I mean, even then, still putting up a sign and saying, hey, watch your step, or hey, the floor is slippery, something like that, would be best to kind of get yourself out of liability.
Got it. So like, let's say somebody's, you know, walking on a sidewalk that's right in front of your property. And, you know, there's a huge crack in the sidewalk. If you just put a sign in a lawn that says, watch your step next to the crack, that might be helpful. Something like
that would be very helpful. Very helpful. And then it'll also get down to, well, you know, obviously as an attorney, we pull the records and look at the boundaries of the property. Do you actually own the sidewalk or is it owned by the government? Yeah. Right. So we get into some of that stuff as well.
Yeah. Cause even if it's owned by the government, isn't there, wouldn't you still be held responsible for it for the maintenance and upkeep, or how does that work?
So it depends on the jurisdiction, but if it's like, you know, completely owned by the government, then that's really not your responsibility. Obviously, we want to make sure it looks pretty just for, you know, the property value and things like that, appraisals and stuff. But if it's owned by the federal government, then that's their responsibility. So it's almost like if there's a crack in the street, but the street is right in front of your house, you're not required to go out there and start laying cement and stuff like that. That's the government's job, right? Yeah. So maybe you can call the government and say, hey, it's a crack in the sidewalk or whatever, and notify them. But ultimately, if it's the government's property, then they're responsible for it.
Got it. So, you know, again, liabilities can be avoided. You know, we talked about a couple of different things that, you know, you might want to keep in mind as a real estate investor, having your contracts, you know, in writing with your team. So your contractors and anybody else who's on your team, right? Physicalities, right? So you got, you know, maybe some issues with the property, putting up signs, making sure that people want to, if there's a dog on the property, obviously, you know, if your tenant has a dog, beware of dog, no trespassing, stuff like that, right? All of these different things that you definitely want to keep in mind to avoid these liabilities. Are there any other liabilities that we should keep in mind?
there's always a ton of liabilities. The other thing that I would say watch out for is when you're selling a property, just make sure you're fully disclosing any type of defects to the property and things like that, because that's a huge way to be on the line and be liable, right? Here in Texas, we have something called deceptive trade practices, right? And so that's a major way to get on the hook for being deceptive. If you're selling a property, but you're not disclosing some type of defect, something that's not readily either visible or apparent to some type of inspector or something, but you knew about it and you had the opportunity to disclose it and you didn't, that would be a huge liability risk for an investor. So I would say, if you know of some type of defects on the property, and not just real estate investors, just business owners in general, when you're doing business deals, if it's some type of defects and something you're selling, always just make people aware of it. So that way you're being fully honest and disclosing everything. And then there's no liability for it.
Got it. And a great example of that would be a property that I used to own where we had, property line issues, right? So the neighbor thought that part of the property was his. When we looked at the map, it was actually my property. So when I go and sell the property, I got to disclose that. Look, the neighbor has a dog on the property. It's a flip. I didn't take the time to really argue with the neighbor and tell him to take his doghouse off of the property. But, at the end of the day, I mean, that was my property. If I didn't disclose it and the buyer has to go out and fight for that, then that would be my issue, wouldn't it be?
Right. Yeah. So you were being forthcoming by letting them know, hey, I got this issue with this neighbor. They've been leaving their dog on this portion of the property, even though it belongs to me. So that way they're aware going into the deal what they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. The guy even built a 2-car slab on the property as well. He really thought it was his.
You never addressed it.
Yeah, I just, I spoke to him about it. I said, I'm selling the property. This may come back to you later on. I was able to sell the property as it was, but, the person knows about it who bought it. So however they handle it, that's entirely up to them. Should I have gotten that in writing?
With the neighbor?
With the new homeowner.
Yeah, you always want to disclose in writing, because even though it sounds like you made a verbal disclosure.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. So they could have turned around and 2 months after buying the property and said, we really don't want to deal with this crazy neighbor, and then try to use that as the basis to get out of the deal. Yeah. But, obviously it would be your word against theirs. Mm-hmm. But I always recommend to all business owners, just put it in writing.
Yeah, and that's one of those you live and you learn type of things, right? I've been in real estate for over 20 years. I'm still learning. So
always learning.
That's right.
And people, regardless of what industry you're in, you're always learning. I think that to be the smartest person in the room is a downfall. You always want to be the student and the teacher, if you will, right?
That's right. That's right. And people change over time. So you like you said, you always want to, you always want to be mindful that you're always learning, because you got to adapt to every situation as it happens, So something like that has never happened to me before. So I'm not thinking about it, but it worked out anyway. So hopefully, that won't come back to bite me in the future.
Now you're all sophisticated. Now you'll have it in writing and everything. You'll be good to go.
Right. Which kind of leads into some real estate do's and don'ts that we want to talk about, right? So what are some of the real estate do's and don'ts that our listeners should be mindful of as they tap into the real estate investing businesses?
Absolutely. So I think the area that gets most investors in trouble is when they're dealing with tenants, okay? So when you're dealing with the tenants, tenants are allowed to have notice for literally everything. So a lot of investors get tripped up. Say, for example, if the investor is selling the property, you have to give the tenant notice that the property is being sold to a new landlord. So every step of the way, they have to have notice. So that's one of the biggest tips that I would give to investors.
Even if they don't have a lease, just for clarity, even if they don't have a lease, right?
Yeah, right. So when it comes to real estate, the rule is it has to be in writing when it comes to real estate, but just think about it. Sometimes you might let your friends stay over, and then now they've acquired some type of rights to stay. Even if you call the police won't, make them leave. So even if you just let somebody come over and stay the night, and they end up staying for 60 days or something like that, they still have a right now to be at the premises. So just to make sure you're following all the technicalities, even if they don't have a written lease, if you have some type of verbal agreement that they can stay here or something like that, you still want to give them notice about the sale.
Got
So
it.
always, always, always give the tenants notice.
Always give the tenants notice. What are some other real estate do's and don'ts that you can think of?
Yeah, so investors usually, when they're doing, like, if you have a rowdy tenant, if you will, a lot of investors would do what's called a cash for keys deal with the tenant. And most of them, they don't put it in writing. So we were just talking about you putting your disclosures in writing. But if you come up with some type of deal with the tenant to get them out, I understand some tenants are just knuckleheads. But if you say, hey, I'm going to give you $500 and you'll be out in 30 days, do not trust the tenant to honor their word, right? Do not trust them. They'll keep the 500 and still stay there, and then you be the one on the hook for violating the law for trying to, evict them, right? So in those type of situations, put it in writing, and then always go and consult with the lawyer first to make sure that when you are putting it in writing, that you're using the right trigger, the right key terms and things like that to protect you under the law. So that's another tip. Have you had any experience in that area
Yeah,
with the cash for
well,
keys?
I've had a ton of tenants, but I always get that in writing. I remember one situation where I bought a property about 30 minutes from here, and it was in a smaller city, and the property it was a property on Fleetwood Drive. Now, we shared the three houses shared a dirt road leading up into where the properties were. So there was a forget the type of agreement's name that we had in order to, keep the drive the drive through into the properties neat and clean, and everybody's maintaining it. I think it was a maintenance agreement or something like that. We called it. There was another name for it. It's not coming to mind right now, but I remember because I had, and I didn't look into this before I bought the property. I buy properties distressed, so I'm not necessarily looking at everything that's tied to the property. That's kind of how that situation with the doghouse happened, right? But bought the property, rehab the property, and I go to sell the property, and it turns out that there was this maintenance agreement, a maintenance or a road maintenance agreement. I think that's what it was. Road maintenance agreement with all the property owners on that particular road. The first house, so basically the road maintenance agreement expired. We needed to renew it in order for me to sell the house. So I went to I had a neighbor on my left and a neighbor on my right. I went to the neighbor on the right, and he agreed, signed it right away. The neighbor on the left gave me a hard time. So I offered him $1,000 just to sign just to sign the maintenance agreement. Had to take him out for coffee, talk to him, read the agreement with a young guy. I really wanted to put my hand. No, I'm just kidding. I really just wanted to strong arm him a little bit, but
But they say you get more bees with honey. So sometimes you have
yeah, for sure. I'm joking about that, but
to. Yeah.
I ended up giving him $1,000 just to kind of sign. And even then, he was like, oh, let me think. He was being a butthead about it. He just wanted to give me a hard time about it. But he ended up signing the agreement. But I got that in writing. And had I not, it would have been a verbal agreement. And the whole deal would have went sour because of it. So the bank wanted it in writing, which was perfect. And most banks do, right? They force you, and that way they're protected on their end as well. So that just shows how important it is to get stuff in writing, because once you have it in writing, this person, now I could take this guy to court if he doesn't live up to his end of the bargain, which is a whole nother thing. If you're taking somebody to court and winning a lawsuit, you still got to be able to collect the money. I've been there. I've been there as well. I've taken contractors to court, and the contractor didn't have anything, at the end of the day, and now, I'm stuck with the bill, but
Yeah, and not just the that aspect of the lawsuit, it's that It's cheaper to get it in writing versus paying an attorney, right? So then you got to pay an attorney $10,000 just to go and sue someone who may or may not have the money, which, by the way, you guys probably should research before you file the lawsuit.
That's right.
To see if they got some money, right?
That's right.
But yeah.
But this contractor, he had some properties he owned. He had, like, his cars, his business cars and stuff under the business. So that's kind of what we had to go after he didn't want to up the money. So you got to handle stuff the right way. You know, you gotta put stuff in writing, and you got to use the justice system against people sometimes, unfortunately, because people are not honest. But
So now let me ask you, you said that you guys had to end up going after the properties and cars and stuff he had. Was it under the same business name that you guys did business? Yeah.
So I got his car towed away. He got a couple of things taken until he finally paid up, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Good. So, yeah, you can enforce a judgment against, you know, someone's assets. So even if they don't have money in the bank account, you can start forcing the sale of their assets. So that's right. Another good tip right there is with investors, you guys typically have a ton of properties, especially when you get really experienced like you, 20 years in the game. I know you got a ton of assets, right? And so a sophisticated investor like you, you're going to have multiple different entities protecting different assets, right? So it would be foolish to have, say, 50 properties under one LLC, right? Because if that LLC got sued, now all of those properties are on the line to pay a judgment, right? That's another really good tip that we just kind of created here, flowing with each other. But yeah, so always have separate entities. And then take extra measures, which I'm sure you have as well, to put those entities in a trust also to make it a little more difficult for people to file suit. I think I was telling you guys at the conference where we met how I was trying to go after this big real estate company for screwing over my client. And like I was scratching my head trying to find out who the actual owner was because they had everything buried in all these trusts. And, you know, trusts, they're not public records. So it's not like you can just go on the Secretary of State's website and figure out who owns this trust. So that's another really huge tip for investors, having separate entities for, you know, their assets and then at some point or another, being sophisticated enough to put those assets in a trust.
For sure. Do you recommend having more than one property under one LLC?
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to get too psycho crazy with it. You don't want to have, you know, 10,000 different LLCs, you know? So I say what you should do is, and it also depends on how big of an investor you are. Mm-hmm. So maybe set a threshold, say, okay, every 10 properties, I'm going to create a separate LLC. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of up to you what you're comfortable with and how large of an investor you are, right? Obviously, you got some investors out here that might own an entire development, an entire community, and that community might have about 75, you know, houses in it. So then that obviously can be one corporation or one LLC. Yeah. You don't want to go and every house in the development has a different LLC. That'd be kind of silly. But you kind of catch where I'm going. Just set you a threshold.
Yeah. The old rule of thumb as I was coming up in my early days as an investor was every 5 properties, put it under a different LLC, right? But then I became a firm believer in trust as well. So really, if you're using your LLC as a PR for your trust to represent the trust, you really only need one LLC, but you know, at the end of the day, you can have a different trust for each property. Would you agree with something like that setup, or how would you do it differently?
I still wouldn't have just one LLC. That makes me uncomfortable just because, golly, we don't even want one multiple lawsuits attached to the LLC name, right? Because listen, you might be going to do business with someone new and then they're going to start researching you. So when my clients want to do business with someone new, I'm researching the company just to be able to advise them if this is a good business deal, not just what's on paper, but this particular company, their owners, are they savvy business people? Do they screw people over? Have they been sued in the last 5, 10 years, right? So even though, you know, logically speaking, it can work that way, having one LLC and multiple different trusts. I just would prefer if my clients had multiple different LLCs and then separate trusts attached to them.
Got you. That makes a whole lot of sense. And another thing that I think is super important for people to keep in mind when it comes to the trust aspect of things, like you said, it was very difficult for you to find who the owners of that trust was, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge retainer that an attorney is going to want, likely $10,000 or more, just to do some research. And most people don't want to pay that. So that makes it very difficult. Like, how many people do you know would actually go after somebody who has their property under a trust and they got to put down a retainer? You know what I mean? It's easy to find the owner of an LLC, but a trust, that's very difficult. So that retainer is going to deflect a lot of sue happy people that want to go after your assets, but they don't want to put up the money to be able to do it. Do you agree with something like that, or?
Absolutely. I do agree, because I'm telling you, I was sitting scratching my head. Like, I was like, man, they really hit this thing, you know? So you can find out who they are. It's just very, very difficult. It's not as readily accessible. Yeah. So it serves kind of as a deterrent, right, to file a suit. So unless it's some type of like major, like multi-million-dollar case, it's kind of like, do I even feel like being bothered with this?
Yeah.
So it's more so a deterrent. It's not going to save you from all lawsuits, of course, but it's more of a deterrent. And that's what we want. We kind of want to deter people from filing a lawsuit. Of course, we're going to be doing good business practices, but also we just want to put up some blockages to say, no, it's not going to be as easy to find me or sue me.
And a lot of it is also, you know, when you put your properties under a trust, you don't necessarily have to. Like a trust is not a public document. So you don't necessarily have to file it down at the courthouse. So it's like, I could set up a trust right now and put the paperwork in my file cabinet. You got to figure it out. Right. So that's what makes it difficult for the attorney to really find out who's behind that trust, who the beneficiaries are, because, you know, and that's why it costs so much money to be able to get this research done. And that's why, you know, a lot of people steer themselves away from it. So that's why I'm a firm believer. And if you're going to hold properties, the trust factor is huge. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's going to limit your liability, you know, and basically offer you that privacy that you're looking for as an investor or a business owner at the end of the day. You know?
Yeah. Speaking of which, the privacy aspects, I know a lot of people are were upset going into the year because of the Corporate Transparency Act. So that was a huge topic of conversation. But, you know, people are disclosing to the federal government, so you still are able to be anonymous to the general public, you know? Yeah.
They have that information anyway, don't they?
Yeah, the federal government has everything, right? That's why I'm kind of like, they really did need the Corporate Transparency Act.
Right.
But again, from my legal perspective, I see it as more of a deterrent for criminals because we had a lot of scammers, people committing fraud under these different LLCs. So what the federal government is doing is kind of trying to set up a deterrent. Like, hey, now we're requiring you to report all your information. So it's kind of a deterrent, right? Yeah. It's kind of scaring the criminals a little bit. I guess just a little bit. They always find a way to still do things, right? Just a little bit is going to deter them. Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds good. So how can our listeners get in contact with you?
Oh, sure. So my office number is 844-480-0480. And then you can also visit me on social media platforms at Attorney Candace.
Now, Attorney Candace, let me tell you, she's flying airplanes and doing all kinds of all kinds of stuff. You guys got to check out her social media pages. She's definitely doing her thing and just making being a business owner exciting. You know what I mean? So definitely check it out. I think you guys are really going to enjoy the content that she puts out. I'm going to link her information in the description box of this podcast episode so that you guys can get in contact with her. If you just want to know a little bit more about business, if you just want to know more about the legal side of things or how to even grow a business, you know, she's definitely well-versed in all of these different areas. And I highly recommend that you reach out to her. She's definitely doing her thing in this regard. Any last words for our listeners at all?
I appreciate that, Jamel. The last words is check out also some of my courses. I always forget to talk about it, but years ago I created courses educating business owners on how to review a business contract, how to do their own trademarks, stuff like that, just because I recognize that some of business owners, they don't necessarily have the money to afford an attorney like me. So now you have a course where I'm teaching you all of my knowledge, but you do it yourself. So go check out some of that stuff as well, because in 2024, we want to make sure there are no excuses, okay? Yeah, no excuses. So those are my last words of wisdom. Yeah.
Perfect. So thanks, Jamel. No excuses at all. Oh, of course. Of course. I appreciate you. I've been trying to get you on this podcast for a while. I'm happy we finally made it happen. I'm sure this is not the last one. Listen, guys, you know, at the end of the day, we're not trying to make excuses this year. We're trying to do what we have to do. So the best thing you can do is reach out to a knowledgeable attorney to add the attorney to your team. Candace is definitely that person. If you're looking for help with intellectual properties for your business, your logos and things like that, if you're looking to avoid pitfalls in your business, if you're looking to avoid liabilities in your business, definitely reach out. Anything real estate or business related, Candace is the person to contact. I highly recommend her. Link will be in the description box for you guys. And listen, if you want to have her back to talk about another aspect of business and real estate, be sure to leave a comment in the comment section, so that we can know that you guys are interested in having Candace back. I'm sure you guys are, but definitely show us in the comment section how you feel about this particular podcast. Be sure to like this video if you're watching this on YouTube. Subscribe to the channel. Click the notification bell so you can get more videos just like this. I'm going to see you guys on the next one. Take care.